Well, welcome to our friends from Common Bonds. To let you know what we're doing, we are in the midst of a Bible survey, and it took us a year to get through the Old Testament. So that's been exciting. But we finished the Old Testament actually just last week. And what I want to do now is I want to take a little bit of time to talk about the intertestamental period. We'll probably be on this for 2 or maybe 3 weeks. After the book of Malachi in our English Bibles, but after the book of Chronicles is finished, probably one of the 2 or 3 last books, Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, in the Old Testament, there are about 430 years where we essentially hear nothing from the Lord. We call it often the 400 years of silence, but on the world stage, things are far from silent. Okay, and in the New Testament, there is a theme that talks about the fact that Christ came at the fullness of time. And I want to take some time over these couple of weeks and consider how it is that God set up the world stage for first the coming of Christ, then the giving of the New Testament, and as we'll see even in the book of Acts, the rapid worldwide spread of Christianity. So we see the fulfillment of the Great Commission happen in a way that it couldn't have happened before the time that it did happen at any time in the history of the world because of some of the events that took place between the Testaments. So what we're going to do, actually, we're going to back up a little bit, and you guys can turn to the book of Daniel because we're going to use that as our guide as I tried to figure out what to include and what not to include and what was important. I thought, oh, wait, God tells us what's important. He told Daniel what was going to happen for the next several hundred years. So we'll use that as our guide as we go. We will jump back and forth between Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Daniel 11 just a little bit, Daniel 10, some of those different passages. But to back up, Daniel starts with the Babylonian Empire. So we're going to actually talk a little bit about the Babylonians this morning, as well as some of these intertestamental kingdoms. Just a reminder of some dates that will help you guys as we remember what happens from the end of the Old Testament and then we run through to the New Testament. In 722 BC, remember BC, you count backwards and you get bigger, right? Because we're talking about the number of years before Christ came. 722 BC, the Assyrian Empire comes down from north of Israel, and remember, Israel is separated into 2 different nations, essentially, the northern 10 tribes, who are called Israel, we call them, and the southern 2 tribes that we call Judah. And the Assyrians essentially destroy the northern 10 tribes. Okay, they take them into captivity, they conquer them, take them into captivity, and scatter them to the ends of the earth. The next major kingdom on the scene is Babylon. In 605, 597, and 586 BC, those 3 different times, the Babylonians come into Jerusalem, and either each time, I suppose, they conquer it to some degree, but they take either the upper crust, the who's who and the muckety-mucks out of Judah, or in 586, they destroy Jerusalem, and they take everybody who's really not dirt poor destitute, and they take them back to Babylon. 536 BC, the returns out of the exile begin under the Persians. All right, that's when Ezra leads a group of Judeans, of Israelites, back to Judah, and they lay the foundations for the altar, for the temple. A year after that or so, the rebuilding of the temple begins. And we have some biblical record in Ezra and Nehemiah. Also, the prophets Zechariah and Haggai prophesy during this time. And but by 430 BC, we don't hear anything after that until, again, about 3 BC, when the angels appear to Elizabeth and to Mary, foretelling, or I suppose to John the Baptist's dad, and Zechariah, thank you, that's just gone, to Zechariah and to Mary and to Joseph and the beginnings of what we have in the gospel. Now, during this time, from 430 BC to 3 BC, enormous changes takes place on the world stage. And we see almost nothing of it in the Bible, right? As we leave the Old Testament, we have the Israelites back in Judah. They're just sort of starting the rebuilding stages there. The temple worship is back up and running. The walls have been completed. The city is rebuilt and repopulated. The city of Jerusalem is rebuilt and repopulated. And then we skip forward to Jesus being born, and Rome is in charge. This nation that at 430 BC was a very small republic and in its early republican stages. By now, the republic is crumbling. It's turning into an empire. It is the world power, however. They have conquered everyone who's anyone, and they are the dominant world power. We go from Aramaic, being the lingua franca in Jerusalem and in Judea and in Israel, to now the Greek language and Greek culture have unified much of the known world. Now, this is going to present some challenges for the Jewish worldview, as we'll see, and it also drives in them a hunger for their Messiah to deliver them from the rule of Rome. This uniting of the world is going to pave the way, as I said, for the worldwide spread of Christianity. And what we're going to talk about is, how does this happen? Now, just again, an idea of what we're dealing with in that intertestamental period. Babylon is the world power from about 612 to 539 BC. They take over Nineveh, which is the capital of Assyria, in 612 BC. 539 BC is when Babylon falls. You remember the story of Belshazzar, the writing on the wall, and that's when the Medo-Persian Empire comes in and they take Babylon essentially without any fighting even. Medo-Persia then is the major world power from about 539 to 334 BC. In 334 BC is when one of my favorite characters in all of history comes onto the stage. That is Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great conquers the world almost literally in 10 years. He is certainly leopard-like in the quickness with which he moves. And Greece then becomes the dominant world power and the uniting world power from 334 BC to about 64 BC. And then from 64 BC on to whenever, after we're done considering the time frame, Rome is the power in the world. So what we're going to see here as we consider this intertestamental period is that God sets the stage for the fullness of the time of the Messiah in the intertestamental period. And the second thing I was struck by is the reliability of prophecy. We're going to see that Daniel, with great accuracy, explains to us exactly what's going to happen in this time period. So turn to Daniel. And there are a couple of different times that Daniel sees visions of the nations and what's going to happen in this intertestamental period. And the first time is in Daniel chapter 7. So look at Daniel chapter 7. In the first year, in verse 1, of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, so this is very near the end of the Babylonian Empire, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dreams down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, "I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another." Now, these four beasts are going to represent four kingdoms and four kings. The first was like a lion. He had the wings of an eagle. "I kept looking until his wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it." This is representative in Daniel's dream of the nation Babylon and the empire that Babylon had. We see here that it's represented first by a lion, and then a lion specifically with wings. So he's a little bit of a strange-looking lion, apparently. But the idea of a lion and the idea of wings are both attributed to Babylon in Jeremiah chapter 4, verses 7 and 13, where God's judgment on Judah via Babylon is foretold. So we see a lion, obviously it's the idea of a predator, a conquering kingdom, a conquering group. And the wings here probably point us toward the fact that Babylon is fast. They move quickly. It points us back to, like I said, using the terminology there of the lion and the wings, pointing us to Jeremiah. It probably points us to the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was going to, or had invaded Judah. It had conquered Jerusalem in 605. It came back. They came back. They destroyed Jerusalem in 586. And the rest of this talking about the kingdom here, his wings are plucked. He's lifted up from the ground, made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a human mind was given to it. Probably this is a reference to Daniel chapter 4, when we see that Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest king of the Babylonians, was made insane because of his pride and his arrogance at what he had done, at what he had built in Babylon. For 7 years, he walks around like an animal. His hair grows like feathers on his head. He eats grass, but his reason is restored to him when he looks to heaven and recognizes that it is the God of heaven who bestows upon man all the nations of the earth. And it seems that even this verse points to the possibility that Nebuchadnezzar was converted in that to a worshiper of the Lord, that he was given the heart of a man. He was insane. He was restored and converted during his reign. And just to give you an idea, oops, you know what? I forgot my pointer. I'm going to need this. This is going to feel, I felt like I was back in college this week. My degree is in history, and so we're going to see a lot of history. You can see here is the reaches of the Babylonian Empire. Here is Egypt and the Nile River right here, if that gives you an idea. Here's modern-day Turkey. I may refer to it often as Asia Minor because that's that region of the world here. This is Asia Minor. Iraq, here is the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and right in here is Israel and Jerusalem. So this is the Mediterranean Sea, the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. And you see that this is quite an extensive empire under King Nebuchadnezzar. And I show you some of these things because I want you to see sort of how the empires get bigger and bigger and bigger and all of the different things that they're able to do. By the way, Babylon is right here on the Euphrates River. So hopefully that kind of gets you set in your mind as far as what part of the world we're in. But then in 539 BC, like we said, it falls to the Persians. Babylon falls to the Persians under Cyrus the Great. Now we're going to come back to that and talk about that just a little bit, but you remember the story, like I said, of Belshazzar and the handwriting on the wall. In that conquest, the Persians come in, and remember, Persia is Iran, modern day Iran. And so they come in. Babylon sits, you can see here, right on the banks of the Euphrates, and they had come to the city of Babylon, and the rulers in Babylon are feeling pretty comfortable because you have basically an impregnable wall on three sides of the city and then a huge river on the fourth side of the city. And what they did in order to get into the city of Babylon is they essentially diverted the river. They dug big reservoirs and brought a bunch of the water flowing through the Euphrates into those reservoirs. And then it says, the historical accounts say that the water came down in the river to like thigh height of a man. So they were able to march their army right into Babylon. They took the city without even a battle. They were in the city before anybody knew it. A couple of things I want to bring to the fore with each of these nations. First of all, their policy of conquest. Because in this period of time, Daniel calls this time the period of the Gentiles, or the time of the Gentiles, which means that Israel is going to be ruled and at the mercy of the Gentile nations. And we've seen something of the Babylonian policy of conquest already. They take the best and the brightest from the conquered places to the city of Babylon in order to enhance the quality of Babylon. You'll remember here, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were some of the best and the brightest. They were taken to Babylon, and where do we see these guys? They're in the service of Nebuchadnezzar and then the following kings, right? They are helping out in the ruling of the nation. We see that Daniel especially reaches very high heights and is set over sort of like a prime minister sort of role and function. So the Jews are taken out of Jerusalem and out of the land. They take the cream of the crop. And the other thing that this does for Babylon is that without their leaders, the people don't rebel, right? If you take all of the people who are organizers, all of the people who are leaders, you take all of the people who are inspirers, and you take them away from the people, what you have left is a very much subjugated people. And that's the Babylonian philosophy. So the way that Israel sits under Babylon is people are taken into exile. Some of the cream of the crop flourished in Babylon, right? Some of the best people in their society, they flourished in Babylon, although there was great temptation there to assimilate, to take on the Babylonian customs and food and all of this. And that causes problems because what is Israel? Edge, especially. They're God's chosen nation, right? And they're supposed to be what kind of nation? A holy nation. And if they're a holy nation, that fundamentally means they're supposed to be set apart, different, not assimilated. All right? And that's going to cause problems for the Israelites throughout. Those left in Israel were extremely poor and mixed very much so with the surrounding peoples. And that's some of the problems that we have when we come to Ezra and Nehemiah and get into the mixed marriages and different things like that. So that's the Babylonian Empire. And we see 536 BC is as they're falling, but that's the reaches of the empire. Look back in Daniel chapter 7 now. We see that the next nation, another beast, a second one resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said, "Arise, devour much meat." This is talking about the Persian Empire. Okay, this is talking about the Persian Empire. And it's fitting that God allows Daniel to understand something about the Persians when he talks about a bear. When you think of a bear, what do you think of? What's that? He's huge, right? And they just kind of lumber. And then if they get to running, they're fast, but you don't want to be in the way, and then they just maul whatever is in front of them. And that's the way the Persian army worked. It was enormous. It was huge. And they took everybody with them. All of the rulers and all of the leaders and all of their families and all of that, they had enormous entourages that just went all over the place wherever the Persian army went. And hundreds of thousands of people would go on the expedition as the army went out to conquer. Take a look over at chapter 8, verse 3. Notice there in chapter 7 that the bear is raised up on one side. And we have another vision, a vision of a ram and a goat. And a small horn in chapter 8. And the ram, again, is representative of Medo-Persia. I lifted up my eyes in verse 3 and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns. It was standing on the front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. So what we see out of this empire, one of the major features of this empire is that it is two-pronged. There are two parts, and one of them is bigger than the other. But the bigger part is the part that comes up later. And that's where we get the Medes and the Persians. All right, to start out, at the beginning of the rise of the Medo-Persian Empire, the Medes are in control. All right, but what is it? The Medes are in power at first, but in 553 BC, a man named Cyrus the Great, he led the Persians in revolt against the Medes, and they destroy or they take over the power that the Medes had, and the Persians do here, and then Cyrus expands the empire enormously. All right, he expands the empire enormously. Take a look at chapter 8 here, verse 4. So we have this two-pronged empire. The Medes are first. The Persians come later, but they get bigger and stronger. And I saw the ram, budding westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him. Nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. So here is here's the Persian area or province here. Media is big, but Cyrus the Great leads Persia in a revolt, and then they go everywhere. They go north, they go south, and they go west in particular. And so under Cyrus the Great and under his son Cambyses, something like that, they vastly expand the Persian Empire. And by 500 BC, this is what the empire looks like. Now, Babylon was big, right? It was a big empire. But look at the degree to which the Persian Empire expands upon that. You know, we saw this part of the map kind of right in here with Babylon. We go all the way back over into, here are the Hindus. These are the Himalaya Mountains. So this is India, all the way back here. So this is up into Thrace. Greece is right down in here. Macedonia is right in here. That's going to become important for us in a little bit. Again, here's Turkey today, Asia Minor, and then down into Egypt. And so, remember the bear had three bones in his mouth, three ribs in his mouth, and the ram goes northward, westward, and southward. And there were three major conquests here during this time for the Persian Empire. And at first they pushed here into Asia Minor, and they call that the conquest of Lydia and Asia Minor in 547 BC. Then they came down, and under Cyrus the Great, the Persians defeated the Medes, and they also then take over Babylon. Remember we talked about that here just recently. Both of those expeditions were under Cyrus the Great, and then in 525 BC they come down into Egypt and start to invade and take territory in Egypt, and that's under Cyrus's son. So you have the Persian Empire. If Babylon was big, Medo-Persia is enormous. Three important kings, Cyrus, that we've talked about, Darius the First. Now, for you history buffs, you'll remember Darius the First is the one. He's the first of the Persian kings who tries to invade Greece. And Greece is going to be what the Persians try and take over and are never able to. The Battle of Marathon. You've heard of the Battle of Marathon, where the guy is supposed to have run either from Athens to Sparta or from the battlefield to Athens, depends on who you listen to ask for help and to give news of what was going on. That happened against Darius the Great. Here, Athens, which is down in here, is able to defeat the Persians as they try and come in and destroy Athens in retaliation for Athens' part in a revolt that kind of happens up here in this area. So Darius says, I'm going to destroy Athens, but the Athenians are able to, at the plain of Marathon, keep the Persians from coming inland, essentially. They were able to hold some strategic positions. And then they had to turn around because, Darius took his ships and he, with all of the Athenian army out at Marathon, he sailed the ships around and they were going to try and then attack Athens directly. And the Athenian army is able to turn around and march back. And that's the beginnings, really, of Athens' domination over the Grecian area. So under Darius the First, they invade Greece in retaliation for Athens for an Ionian revolt. And that's the defeat at Marathon. And then Xerxes the First. Anybody know Xerxes the First by a better name? Edgebetter. Yeah, we know Xerxes in the Bible is Ahasuerus. And Ahasuerus is the king of Persia in Ruth. All right. I was hoping we'd know that, but so Xerxes the First reigned from 485 to 465. He invaded Greece. This is the Persian king that is defeat or that wins at Thermopylae. Now, who do we know better at Thermopylae? 300 Spartans, right? And King Leonidas, as they try to hold off Persia, the Persian army, the great Persian army at the pass at Thermopylae, as they are ready to come in. But then they are defeated. The Persians are defeated at Salamis and sent back. And that's what makes Ahasuerus sad and want a new queen. And then we have the story of Esther. So the battle that Ahasuerus, that Xerxes is planning for at the beginning of the book of Esther is this invasion of Greece, where they win at Thermopylae because they totally overwhelm the 300 Spartans, but they lose in the overall picture of things. The other thing, this becomes important for is their invasions of Greece is that it really starts to bind the Greek city-states together. Okay? Up until this point, the Greek, and still at this point, the Greece functions in a group of city-states. So each city sort of governs itself and the land around it, and they're fiercely independent of each other. Okay, they don't want to get together, they don't want to work together, they fight each other, and they fight each other, and they fight each other. Well, there's nothing better to bring warring factions together than to bring in an outside force that forces them to get together and fight to survive together. All right, and so you have the beginnings of that happening in the 5th and 6th centuries BC as the Persians try to come in. And what's going to happen ultimately is the In Macedonia, up here on the north part of the Ionian Sea, a man named Philip and then his son Alexander put together a full-time army. They are better at fighting than everyone else. They eventually unite the Greek city-states, as we're going to see here in just a minute. And Alexander is going to go, and he is going to wipe out the Persian Empire. And the way that part of the reason that he is able to do that is the enormity and diversity of the Persian Empire. All right? The Persians, in their policy of conquest, Cyrus was famously accepting of conquered culture and religion. Okay, so the Persian idea, where Babylon was, take all of their important people, bring them to Babylon, it will strengthen Babylon, it will weaken, those outside groups, those conquered groups. Cyrus and Persia say, as long as the outside groups pay taxes, we could care less what they do. All right. So this is kind of a live and let live and just send us your taxes and then send us your armies if we call for them. But, you know, hopefully you'll leave well enough alone here and know better than to rebel against us. And so this is part of the reason. This is part of what moves Cyrus, to issue a decree, to have Ezra take a bunch of priests and a bunch of people back to Jerusalem. And you'll remember it's Cyrus's decree that sends the people back to Jerusalem. And it's the Persian kings who allow the temple to be rebuilt, the city of Jerusalem to be rebuilt, and the walls to be rebuilt under Ezra and Nehemiah and their leadership. So they mostly leave peoples to themselves. They let them practice their local customs. The decrees for the Jews to return to rebuild the temple in Ezra, to rebuild the walls in Nehemiah. And the resulting situation for Israel is that it's generally a favorable time. They're allowed to return to their nation. They're allowed to rebuild their city of Jerusalem. They're left alone as long as they pay taxes and everybody gets along pretty well. What happens in Israel during this time is essentially the high priest becomes the de facto leader. Okay, he becomes the de facto ruler of the people. But you have their Israel faring fairly well. Now I mentioned to you, the fall of the Persian Empire happens because of its size and its diversity, but mostly because of the ingenuity and the brilliance of one man, and that is Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great leads us to the Greek Empire. Now, Alexander the Great leads us to the Greek Empire. So look at chapter 8, verse 5 in the book of Daniel. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Look back in chapter 7 at verse 6. After this, I kept looking. Behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird, and the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So in chapter 8, we see that we have now a goat, and he comes, and he has one conspicuous horn. And this conspicuous horn is representative of Alexander. Because if anyone made the Greek Empire, it was Alexander. And he was a singular character in the history of the world. This guy was militarily brilliant. He was unlike anyone the world has ever seen before, and very possibly unlike anyone the world has ever seen since. Like we mentioned here, as Persia attacked Greece, the previous generation's attacks from Persia moved some to unite the Greeks from the city-states. Alexander's father, Philip of Macedon, he conquers Greece. The Greeks are allies, but they're allies because you're going to be my friend and you're going to like it and you're going to be my ally. And he, for the first time, fields a full-time professional army and he turns his attention to Persia. Now, men like this are usually ripe for assassination, right? You make everyone be your friend. You do so through military conquest and military might, and chances are people are not going to like you. We don't know who killed him, but it seems that he was assassinated. And Alexander then was heavily influenced, it's important for us to realize, by Greek culture, especially with his tutor who was named Aristotle. Okay, so you have this whole movement toward unity in Greece, the spreading of Greek culture. Macedonia is actually here on the northern part of the Ionian Sea. Athens, again, is down here. And it's considered kind of outback country. The people are shepherds and they're very rustic, to say the least. Philip understands the value of bringing in Greek thought and Greek culture, so his son is tutored by Aristotle, who was the student of Socrates, who was the student of Plato. So that gives you an idea sort of the Greek thought and the philosophy that influenced. And each of those guys had sort of his own emphasis in Greek philosophy and in his thinking. And Aristotle's thinking was very much a desire to see unity universally. Wow, we've got to move fast. I just looked to see what time it was. So Alexander, heavily influenced by Greek culture, especially with his tutor Aristotle, he had a particular hankering for universal unity. And what we see talked about with Alexander is the speed with which he worked. You remember Babylon was a lion with two wings. Well, back in this other vision, Daniel is a leopard, a big cat, and he has four wings. So if Babylon was faster, Alexander was lightning, okay? And we see that Alexander conquers the world in 10 years. He moves so incredibly quickly, not only in his conquest, but also specifically, tactically and strategically with his army. And we see that characterizes what he does here. Here in chapter 8, he moves without touching the earth, so quickly that he moves without touching the earth. Look at verse 6. He came up to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram. He was enraged at him, and he struck, and the ram shattered his two horns. He struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. So we see that with lightning quickness, Alexander conquers the Persian Empire. Alexander starts here in 334 BC is when he crosses the Hellespont here. He comes there, are a couple of major battles. I'll tell you about at least one of them here in just a minute. He comes through Asia Minor, conquers all the way through here. Here's another major battle at Issus. He comes down into Egypt, conquers Egypt essentially. He comes around. Here is the final battle with the Persians, the final major battle with the Persians, and he fights this battle, I'm trying to remember, in like 331, so in 3 years he has essentially destroyed the mightiest empire on the face of the earth. He marches into Babylon, which again is down here. He comes this direction, keeps going east, swings north, moves around up here in India, here again, the Himalaya Mountains. Alexander, for all he's worth, he wants to push to the end of the world. He wants to go until there is nothing more. They encounter some heavy resistance back here in India. The only thing that turns him around is his army wants to go home. They've been out marching around the earth for several years now. It's been almost 6 or 7 years, something like that, by the time they get up here since they've been home. And so he is prevailed upon to go back home. He goes to Babylon and just up and dies. Very mysterious events with his death, but he conquers the world within 10 years. By 323 is when he dies. Essentially, his army wins battles and wars by moving faster than his opponents, both strategically and tactically. I told you there are three major battles against the Persians. The Battle of Granicus, which is the first time they face the Persian army after they come across, this is called the Hellespont, where you come across these bodies of water. The Black Sea is connected to the Mediterranean Sea, but they cross over here. Here in Northwest Asia Minor, they win the Battle of Granicus. They come down here. The Persians come back and regroup, and Darius isn't with, Darius III, this is a different Darius than we talked about earlier, but Darius III isn't with the army here at Granicus, but he is here at Issus, and Issus becomes the beginning of the end, because the Persian army is defeated even with Darius III there. Again, Alexander comes down around here, and Gaugamela is the final battle against the Persian army. And I want to show you a little bit about this battle at Gaugamela, because it gives us an idea. We're going to have to wrap with Alexander here. But it gives you an idea of the speed with which Alexander works. Okay, here's how the Battle of Gaugamela sets up. All right, the Persian army, like we said, is enormous. Okay, it is, you've got hundreds of thousands of men here, or people that go with this, and you've got all of these troops. Alexander's army is small, but it's very fast. Okay, and so big, Darius here, he sets up Gaugamela exactly like he wants it. He has lots of room to work. If you're the bigger army, you want as much room as you can use, because you want to get around the sides of the other army and come in on them from the side and from the front, and then you win, essentially, is what happens. He had chariots with spikes and all that kind of stuff on them. Chariots were a great advantage. He had the valley, he had the battlefield flattened. He had all of the bushes and shrubs and everything taken out of the battlefield. So Darius has things set up exactly as he wants them set up. Here comes the Macedonian army. Here comes the Greeks. Alexander's here. He's got his second in command over here on his left flank. It's said in the history books that Darius's army outflanks Alexander's army by a mile. Like, literally, his troops go a mile farther out this way than Alexander's troops. And Alexander knows he's going to get flanked. So what he does is he takes Parmenion here, and I think these crossed ones are, these are cavalry, these are horses, these are men, the Greek phalanx. And he sets these groups out here to try and hold the, he knows that Darius is going to try and flank him, and there's nothing he can do about it. Get around on side of him. So he tells Parmenion and these guys, you just have to hold them just long enough. Okay? And so the Persian army starts to come this way. Alexander and a bunch of his troops start to move this way. Darius sends a bunch of his cavalry and a bunch of his troops around to try and get around them. Alexander starts to move this way. What he's trying to do is he's trying to draw as many of Darius's troops that are right here out to the edges. And it works, because they assume that the main attack is going to come from Alexander, and so Alexander starts to move out to the edge. Here's what Alexander does. As soon as he is able to pull these cavalry guys out of position, and these guys have come all the way around, what he's done is he's created a gap in the line, in the Persian line right here. What this takes is perfect timing and extreme speed. Because the whole name of the game now, Alexander, like on, for you guys who are football guys, this is a counter play, essentially. Okay? So the running back goes this way. He tries to get the linebacker to take a false step and create a gap in the defense. And that's what Alexander's done. Darius's line, his cavalry in particular, has almost all come here, and it creates this gap, and it takes perfect timing and extreme speed. Because what happens is, if these guys give out, or these guys give out, before Alexander breaks back to the middle, they're done. The Persian army can just come over and they've totally engulfed them. But what Alexander does is, as soon as this gap comes, he and his cavalry guys and the other guys that he's working with come back to the middle. They punch a hole right here in Darius's ground forces, and they get to Darius, and it's a rout. Darius turns and runs. The Persian army turns and runs. And it's because Alexander is faster to the punch than the Persian army. Alexander's out, man, 2 or 3 to 1 here, and is able to win because he's fast. And that amazes me about prophecy. I show you all of this because it's amazing that the prophetic vision here, hundreds of years before this happens, is that Alexander is going to be able to conquer the world because he moves faster than everybody else. And he is represented by a big cat, by the leopard, and by a goat with four wings, or a leopard with four wings, and by a goat that moves without touching the earth. He just is faster and smarter than everybody else, and he conquers the world. Very quickly, the policy of conquest is this. Cities that opposed were made to pay, like the city of Tyre is totally razed to the ground. Cities that welcomed Alexander and submitted were welcomed into the fold, like Jerusalem was. They were smart enough to go out. The high priest said, hey, our prophets have foretold that you are going to conquer the earth. Alexander goes, I like you. You guys can do whatever you want. Just pay your taxes. And so that's exactly what happens. But Hellenization becomes the key term here. Alexander, I think, understood something about the fact that the Persian Empire fell because of the diversity within the empire. And what Alexander wants to do is he wants to unite the empire through culture. All right. And so he takes the seeds of Greek culture and he spreads them everywhere. He lets people be where they are. He lets them do what they do, but he brings Greek people into everywhere. He founds Greek cities all over the place so that they can become centers of Greek culture and influencing the culture by their presence and uniting the empire by bringing Greek culture to everyone. Now again, this is going to cause some major problems for Israel because they are the holy nation. They are to be set apart. They are to be different. Alexander founds Alexandria's all over the place. He moves Greeks in. He doesn't snuff out cultures. He just tries to integrate them, and this is going to cause problems for the holy people. The Jews are initially treated well by Alexander. They're not really paid much attention to. And they're allowed to continue to worship, and they're allowed to continue to hold their local policy because of the reception in Jerusalem. But remember this idea of Hellenization, because it's going to become key. Once Alexander dies and his generals take over his kingdom. So what we see, God beginning to set the stage. Remember, one of the other things that Alexander is going to do is he's going to bring the language of Greek to the entire world. And you'll notice that the New Testament is written in Greek, and that's very much on purpose. Everyone will be able to read it. Everyone will be able to understand it. And that will feed greatly into the ability of Christianity to spread very quickly. God is setting the stage for his New Testament to come, and particularly for his son. And we see again the amazing accuracy of prophecy and God's word. Let's pray. Father, we thank you so much for your workings in history. We thank you that you are providentially in control of everything that happens, both on the individual level as well as on the enormous worldwide level. Lord, just help us to trust your word as true and accurate. Lord, we thank you that we can look and see that your word has already proven to be so. and be strengthened in our confidence in that. Lord, we pray these things in your Son's precious name. Amen.